The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron, delivering gourmet recipes and fresh ingredients right to your door. Listeners get their first three meals free at blueapron.com/takeaway. That's blueapron.com/takeaway.
This is The Takeaway for Monday, August 29th, 2016.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. I don't know if you caught this or not, but Donald Trump used the tragic occasion of NBA star Dwayne Wade's cousin's death due to gunfire in Chicago on Saturday to declare in a tweet that African Americans, the support of whom for Donald Trump seems to be a number indistinguishable from zero in a lot of places around the country, that African Americans should vote for Trump to solve the violence in their communities. And he's been saying something like this for quite a while now.
What do you have to lose by trying something new like Trump? What do you have to lose?
But with statements like that and the tweet over the weekend, the candidate only attracted more of the incredulous outrage that has been the refrain of this campaign. But Trump might have noted that in his career as a real estate developer, he's had numerous opportunities to address the racial segregation in violent pockets of American cities. Opportunities not taken, apparently. Over the weekend, the New York Times published an investigation highlighting discriminatory housing practices at Trump properties in New York and elsewhere as he apprenticed under his father in his early years of taking over the family real estate business. Wayne Barrett investigated Donald Trump's career since the late 70s as an investigative reporter for the Village Voice newspaper in New York, and he's author of Trump, The Greatest Show on Earth, The Deals and the Downfall and the Reinvention. Wayne Barrett, welcome to the show.
Oh, great to be here.
Would you say Donald Trump, in his career as a real estate developer, was a segregator, someone who actually thought of New York as a place where whites live over here, blacks live over here?
Well, he and his father, you have to lump the two together because, you know, at a very young age, when Donald was still in college, he started at Fordham and then he went on to Penn. But in both places, he worked the summers for his father out here in Brooklyn on Avenue Z, way out by the ocean, where the headquarters were for Fred's little company. But, you know, the company, he was the president of Fred's various companies as a young man, Donald. And so, yes, the two of them actively worked at segregation. I think that the federal government, not only the federal government, but the Nixon Justice Department proved that pretty conclusively twice, really. They brought a race discrimination case against the companies in 1973-74, and then when they got a consent decree out of that, that the Trumps proceeded to violate, they brought another action in 78. So in that time period in the 70s, they were active discriminators, yes.
Can Trump make the argument today that it was a mistake, there were so many government regulations, and that when he realized what was going on, he certainly restored his sense of moral principles as a developer?
Well, he's never even acknowledged that this was an error. He testified in the deposition that he didn't even know what the Fair Housing Act of 1969 was at the time. And it certainly seemed to be unremorseful about these policies. There's never been the slightest indication. He even contended when they signed the consent decree that it was a win, as he always tries to spin stuff. He said it was a win for the Trump organization because they weren't required by the consent decree to take welfare recipients, which, of course, it was never about welfare recipients. Welfare recipients couldn't afford to go into Trump housing. It was about black people who were actually working, middle-income people trying to get into very desirable and very well-built housing. And that was subsidized. Much of it was incredibly subsidized by state and local and federal governments. The big projects that Fred Trump built, Trump Village, Shorehaven, Beach Haven, were all incredibly subsidized, FHA and something under the state Mitchell-Lama law, so that he had all these subsidies. The land was city-owned land that was given to him. He then got assistance in clearing the land, and then he got assistance in mortgage assistance in the construction projects, and yet he thought they should only be for white people.
So what's your impression when you hear Donald Trump talk about crime in African-American communities in places like East New York? We've just had a weekend of serious gun violence here in New York, and I suspect that, you know, Trump would respond by saying what he said on many occasions, that, you know, I'm going to fix this.
Well, it's interesting when he does the litany of cities in his speeches that are crime-ridden, he never mentions New York because he's trying to make a partisan point. The fact is that as dark as he tries to paint this picture, crime is on dramatic decline and has been for many, many years across the country. In most urban areas, there's a slight uptick in some places now in murder data, but across the country, the crime figures are dramatically down. And of course, he tries to paint it as a black phenomenon and to pinpoint it in the cities and blame it on Democrats when national Republican policy has as much to do with the prevalence of poverty in many black neighborhoods in urban areas in the United States. National Republican policy has furthered that rather than moved to correct it in any way.
So putting crime statistics aside, if income inequality is partly to blame for social issues that the federal government either has to deal with or there's a debate over how the government is going to deal with it, would you say that Donald Trump is part of the problem, or his rhetoric suggests he might be part of the solution?
I don't know any way in which he's part of the solution of income inequality. He might go out to East New York and see how many pockets he can pick. I mean, you know, there's never been any indication in his entire career that Donald Trump, who builds luxury housing at the highest possible price. But, you know, I once stood while I was doing this book in front of one of his developments on Park Avenue South. It's called Trump Park at the time, and stood out there one night and watched for a couple of hours that only one light went on during the night, because nobody even lived in these apartments. They're all corporate apartments from some Japanese investor or some corporate entity that came to the United States and they wanted to have a corporate apartment, or they were investments. His father did have a fairly remarkable record, as discriminatory as he was, of building apartments for real working class and middle class families, building a single family and two family housing for them as well, thousands of units, whereas Donald is just built for rich people all his life. That's the total focus of his company. Spend 1 minute on his website, you won't see any consciousness of anybody except the ultra rich.
Wayne Barrett investigated Donald Trump's career since the late 1970s as an investigative reporter for the Village Voice newspaper in New York. He's the author of Trump, The Greatest Show on Earth, The Deals and the Downfall, and The Reinvention. Wayne Barrett, thanks so much. Great to talk to you.
Great talk to you.
So what do we make of the Fair Housing Act of 1968 that was passed to try and prevent what Donald Trump and others managed to accomplish all over America, creating entrenched and now essentially legal housing discrimination and segregation? Is this a segregated nation, and is the Fair Housing Act something that failed or something that was ignored? The U.S. Supreme Court in its last term may have given activists some new tools to fight the segregation in the 21st century. Janae Nelson is Associate Director Counsel of the NAACP Legal Defense and Education Fund, Incorporated.
When we talk about the victims of housing discrimination, we also must talk about the beneficiaries, you know, those who have been given relatively exclusive access to certain social and financial and even public resources like schools by virtue of being able to choose where they live free of discrimination. And then there are groups who disproportionately are unable to exercise that same that same degree of freedom, that same self-determination that we believe is basically as American as apple pie. But for many groups, particularly African Americans, housing discrimination is as American as apple pie.
Trump likes to speak about the violence in African American communities in the city as something he's going to fix. Is there any evidence that he at any point in time as a real estate developer aggressively attempted to enforce or encourage integration in communities that would have actually prevented the kinds of situations that we see ourselves in today?
I'm not aware of any policies or practices that he has used to try to prevent some of the ills that he laments and suggests should encourage African Americans to support him. I do know that such policies exist and as I said, can fulfill the greater mission of legislation like the Fair Housing Act, where there is an obligation to end this segregation and to be affirmative and proactive about doing so. And private developers can play a significant role in this. They are very free to adopt policies that can encourage that degree of integration that would end these separate societies, these separate Americas in which we live. But it's really important to remember that the villains here are not just private landowners or private developers enforcing their own form of personal discrimination. Our government has played a substantial role in perpetuating and enabling residential segregation. You know, it's worth remembering that for decades, federal, state, and local governments proactively enforced a subsidized systemic de jure housing segregation frame in this country. And so the effects of those decades linger with us today. And when you couple that with the actions of private actors, many of whom continue to be subsidized by the government, in the form of tax breaks or loans or other perks, those private actors that may be discriminating intentionally or maybe even unintentionally through policies that disproportionately exclude certain groups, they benefit from the government benefits that they receive. And so it's all intertwined, and it all ensures that residential segregation, and importantly, the inequality that flows from that, will persist.
I just want to clarify. It sounds like what you're saying is that as a presidential candidate, Donald Trump, who is a very famous real estate developer who claims that he's a billionaire as a result of this, if he is critical of what goes on in African-American neighborhoods and is critical of the government that helped create that situation, all he had to do was open his toolkit. There were plenty of ways in which he could have had an impact on precisely those things he criticized today. Is that what you're saying?
What I'm saying is that any private developer can, any landlord, any individual actor can take on the responsibility that was articulated for this nation in the Fair Housing Act and try to end the racial residential segregation that plagues our nation today.
Janae Nelson is Associate Director of Counsel of the NAACP Legal Defense and Educational Fund. After 4 years of siege and bombing, buses evacuated about 8,000 of the remaining residents of the Syrian town of Daraya, a suburb of Damascus, to the cheers of pro-government fighters that you can hear there, took place on Friday. The surrender of the hollowed-out town, a win for the Assad regime, a week after three straight days of incendiary bombs that destroyed the town's one remaining hospital. Meanwhile, in northern Syria, it's a chaotic battleground of militias, nations, and humanitarian agencies that diplomats are trying to clarify. Vice President Joe Biden has met with Turkey's President Erdogan in Ankara, and Secretary of State Kerry has met with Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov in Geneva. Rami Khoury is a senior fellow at the Issam Ferris Institute for Public Policy and International Affairs at the American University of Beirut. He says that the thousands of people who evacuated Daraya were moved to a different part of the war-torn nation.
The fighters were mostly sent to Idlib, where they joined their fellow fighters in the Free Syrian Army and other rebel groups under rebel control, not under the government. About 2,500 civilians were evacuated into other areas, mostly under the government control, but living reasonably securely, one hopes. And then some few thousand stayed in the town. The town is pretty devastated. There's not much there. It has to be pretty much it's rebuilt. But like most of these towns all over Syria and in parts of Iraq, the towns are essentially leveled, and a lot of them are just rubble. But there is the symbolic value of saying either that I captured the town from my opponents, or I withstood the siege and stood my ground, and I'm still here, but the actual town is not, you know, anything worth very much other than symbolic value. And this is one of the problems with warfare, that it's quite irrational, but people do these things.
But does Bashar al-Assad get any credibility here, militarily speaking, from this siege of a suburb of Damascus that now looks more and more like a fortress from which there is no real escape for him?
He gets a tiny little bit of gain credit, maybe, for having pushed the fighters out, and therefore there's no more military resistance in Deraya, resistance against the Assad government. But that is, I think, negated by the overwhelming negative publicity he gets for having essentially subjugated civilians to a medieval-style starvation siege. And it was just awful what people were having to do to survive in some of these places. There's about 10 or 12 other places around Syria that have been subjected to the same kind of starvation sieges. And when people run out of food and then medicine and then ammunition, then they essentially have to give up. And the government policy is to try to negotiate individual agreements with individual towns rather than a blanket wholesale ceasefire agreement with all of the opposition, because the opposition is divided into many different groups, which makes it more complicated as well. So nobody really gains from this. This is just a symbol of the cumulative chronic suffering of, and, you know, dehumanization of everybody involved in these wars and battles inside Syria.
What do you make of the Turkish intervention now that they've decided to change, if not strategy, then their tactics?
You know, the north of Syria is the equivalent of what I used to call in college a cafeteria food fight, where you have like 8 or 10 different people all fighting each other and all, you know, throwing ammunition at the other. And in some cases, friendly people are hitting their own allies, and nobody's quite sure who they're actually fighting. It's one of the most complex, contradictory, and quite bewildering situations, I think, in modern warfare or geostrategic ideological confrontations anywhere in the world. What is clear is that you have some decisive actors. Russia is one of them. Iran is one of them. Turkey is one of them. These three very decisive actors are actually taking whatever action they need to take to preserve what they see as their interest or the interests of their allies. But what you really have going on in the north is a lesson in kind of fortitude and clarity and diligence and persistence, that when a power decides it needs to take action to protect itself, it takes action. And that's what the Turks have done now by going into northern Syria to fight the Kurds and to fight the Islamic State at the same time. It's fascinating that Iran, Turkey, and Russia are playing kind of diplomatic footsies and meeting with each other and working out agreements because they all have certain convergences and interests. And they're, even though they don't like each other in many ways, they also realize that, you know, this isn't a beauty contest. This is hardball, and you need to deal with people that you don't like if that is what gets you certain strategic gains or assets or benefits that serve your national interest. So that's the real story, I think, of northern Syria. It's separating the amateurs from the pros in these kinds of strategic battles between different countries. And unfortunately, it's one more example of the Kurds throughout modern history being sold out by the great powers.
And all the players here get some sort of badge of participation, but the Syrian people get nothing in the end.
There are a lot of Syrians who are actually fighting, along with the Turks and the Russians and others. But the problem is that these decisions about war and peace are not made by Syrian people in any kind of consultative or democratic way. It's a small elite groups of traditional leaders or government leaders who were imposed in an autocratic way. And therefore, ordinary Syrians have no say in what's going on. And that's one of the reasons why they rebelled in the first place 5.5 years ago. And in fact, all over the Arab world, the popular uprisings of the Arab Spring, as it's called, people decided they couldn't live like this anymore. They had to be involved in running their own countries. But the consequences in Syria are far greater than other places because of the savage and ongoing nature of the warfare and the complexities when so many foreign, regional, and international actors get involved.
Rami Khoury is a senior fellow at the Issam Ferris Institute for Public Policy and International Affairs at the American University of Beirut. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron, who knows that incredible ingredients make incredible meals. Blue Apron works with a community of artisanal suppliers, family-run farms, sustainable fisheries, and ethical ranchers to deliver perfectly portioned seasonal ingredients and easy-to-follow recipe cards right to your door. Choose recipes based on your preferences with no weekly commitment. Get your first 3 Blue Apron meals free, plus free shipping, by visiting blueapron.com/takeaway.
We're going to spend a few minutes today now being reminded of one of the historic lyrics of American history. A lyric in historical significance, not unlike this poem from 1892, written by Walt Whitman.
The runaway slave came to my house and stopped outside. I heard his motions crackling the twigs of the woodpile. Through the swung half door of the kitchen, I saw him limpsy and weak, and went where he sat on a log and led him in and assured him, and brought water and filled a tub for his sweated body and bruised feet, and remember perfectly well his revolving eyes and his awkwardness, and remember putting plasters on the galls of his neck and ankles. He stayed with me a week before he was recuperated and passed north. I had him sit next me at table. My firelock leaned in the corner.
That's an excerpt from Leaves of Grass, or this poem, from 1938 by Langston Hughes.
Oh, let my land be a land where liberty is crowned with no false patriotic wreath, but opportunity is real and life is free. Equality is in the air we breathe. I am the poor white, fooled and pushed apart. I am the Negro bearing slavery scars. I am the red man driven from the land. I am the immigrant clutching the hope I seek and finding only the same old stupid plan of dog eat dog, of mighty crush the weak. I am the farmer, bondsman to the soil. I am the worker, sold to the machine. I am the Negro, servant to you all.
These are lyrics of an American nation we learn always struggling to perfect itself and to be a more perfect union. But no, this is only a partial history, a partial poetic history. Hear now this lyric from a man whose name adorns one of the most famous buildings in Washington, D.C., the Russell Senate Office Building, where mostly white men spoke to history in grand lyrics of the principles they held dear. Richard Russell said this: "As one who was born and reared in the atmosphere of the Old South with 6 generations of my forebears now resting beneath Southern soil, I am willing to go as far and make as great a sacrifice to preserve and ensure white supremacy in the social, economic, and political life of our state as any man who lives within her borders." That's Richard Russell, the senator from Georgia, who was willing to lay down his life for white supremacy. It feels and sounds upsetting, so far out of the mainstream of today's politics, coming from a man who quite legally and proudly, and under banner headlines in the leading newspapers of the day, filibustered a civil rights bill back in 1935, an anti-lynching bill. He spoke for 6 straight days to preserve the legality of hanging black people in public by their necks until they were dead, an act we would call terrorism today, called patriotism then. I want to warn you that the language of this legal American politics we like to think of in the abstract is only going to get more upsetting in this little segment, and perhaps you may want to stop listening now, but I hope you don't. At precisely 8:54 p.m. on August 28, 1957, the longest continuous filibuster in U.S. history began as a final stand against a tide of history that was overwhelming the forces of racism and white supremacy that dominated the South and the Southern lawmakers in the U.S. Congress.
The Southern revolt against President Truman reaches its climax at Birmingham under the states' rights banner. Venerable Alfalfa Bill Murray comes out of retirement to join in the protest against the president's civil rights program. More than 6,000 flock to the Rump Convention to select the presidential ticket. In the forefront of the move are Alabama and Mississippi delegates. 13 southern states are represented in the uproarious session, which precedes the nomination of Governors Thurmond of South Carolina and Fielding Wright of Mississippi as party standard bearers.
A decade before Strom Thurmond's filibuster in 1957, southern state separatist leaders had revolted in opposition to President Truman's civil rights platform. Democrats dubbed themselves Dixiecrats and spoke about taking back their country that was being turned into an unrecognizable dictatorship. Here's Democrat Strom Thurmond speaking back then like a member of the Republican faction we would call the Tea Party today.
It simply means that it's another effort on the part of the president to dominate the country by force and to put into effect these uncalled for and these damnable proposals he has recommended under the guise of so-called civil rights. And I tell you, the American people from one side or the other had better wake up and oppose such a program. And if they don't, the next thing will be a totalitarian state in these United States.
But this language you're about to hear, you won't hear from the Tea Party today. Even though it was legal, permissible, newsworthy, and part of the so-called racial debate back in the 1950s and 60s.
There's not enough troops in the army to force the southern people to break down segregation and admit the Negro race into our theaters, into our swimming pools, into our homes, and into our churches.
Listen to that. Admit the Negro race into our theaters, swimming pools, into our homes, and into our churches. End quote. My God, that is upsetting to say. And I grew up at a time when people around me said it all the time. This was a U.S. Senator, Strom Thurmond, who holds a record for filibustering that we may be tempted to note as some kind of Olympic event, continuously talking from 8:54 p.m. on August 28, 1957, to 9:12 p.m. August 29, 1957, the longest filibuster in history, 24 hours, 18 minutes. But it's no Olympic event. It's a lyric of hatred and endorsement of violence and bigotry that stands as a national shame. There's no recording of it. They didn't record it in the Senate back then. But here's some of what he said. Quote, "I am convinced that this is bad proposed legislation which never should have been introduced and which never should have been approved by the Senate. I urge every member of this body to consider this bill most carefully. I hope the Senate will see fit to kill it." That word kill feels as reckless and brutal and offensive as that N-word, spoken without a care in the world in this lyric of hate, a lament for a tradition of segregation, vigilantism, death, and hatred. Disguised as something called states' rights, a principle spoken of quite vigorously today in debates. Governor Strom Thurmond was the party presidential nominee of the Dixiecrats back in 1948. There's a monument to him in Washington and Alabama, places where you can see no monuments or commemoration of the legacy of slavery, Jim Crow, or segregation. Well, maybe there's the White House. It was built by slaves, after all, the First Lady reminded us recently. We should also note that Strom Thurmond lost the political battle. He holds the record for filibustering on that day in 1957. Since we were just talking about Strom Thurmond and the legacy of segregation in the U.S., the N-word and other restrictions on speech in colleges and other institutions, I love this noisy introduction of Senator Strom Thurmond at UCLA back in 1970.
We have to strive at this university to allow all speakers, no matter who they are, what they believe in, to speak freely at this campus.
That intro went on for quite some time, and there were catcalls as well as applause in the background. And I'm wondering, would that same speech happen today on a major American campus? The University of Chicago Dean of Students would say emphatically yes. Dean John Ellison recently wrote in a letter to the incoming university class that the college's, quote, commitment to academic freedom means that we do not support so-called trigger warnings. We do not cancel invited speakers because their topics might prove controversial, and we do not condone the creation of intellectual safe spaces where individuals can retreat from ideas and perspectives at odds with their own. Very few universities have official policies regarding so-called trigger warnings, and this should not be confused for one. While the college does not support trigger warnings and safe spaces, it has no official policy against them, and faculty will choose how to run their classrooms as they see fit. Marianne Case is one of those professors. She's a professor of law at the University of Chicago Law School. Welcome to the program, Marianne Case.
Thanks very much.
So what do you make of this statement? It's short of policy, yet it certainly does espouse some principles.
I think it is a poor statement of our actual policy, which I commend to anyone interested in the subject. A group of my colleagues produced a report on freedom of expression, which set out a couple of years ago what I think the dean was much less clearly and eloquently trying to convey. The policy stood robustly for free speech, saying that it was, quote, not the proper role of the university to attempt to shield individuals from ideas and opinions they find unwelcome, disagreeable, or deeply offensive, although the university greatly values civility and although all members of the university community share in the responsibility for maintaining a climate of mutual respect. Concerns about civility and mutual respect can never be used as a justification for closing off discussion of ideas, however disagreeable or offensive these ideas may be to some members of our community. That's, I think, what the dean was trying to say. And that's a sentiment and an expression of it I, as a member of the faculty, very clearly stand behind. I wish the dean had not used jargon that he might not fully have comprehended, such as trigger warnings and safe spaces.
What's your impression of a trigger warning? What is it, or a safe space? What do you think it is?
Well, I understand. I mean, again, part of the problem is very many different people understand significantly different things, which is why the words should not be used without an explanation of them. I understand a trigger warning to be simply advance notice to a student or a group of students that the material they are likely to encounter in a particular class or in a particular reading might be disturbing, particularly to people with a personal experience of the trauma described. So a classic example of a trigger warning would be, especially in a class or an assignment in which this wouldn't immediately be obvious, there are going to be violent and gruesome descriptions of rape and dismemberment in this thing I'm asking you to read and discuss with me. This is something that sometimes is useful for students to know in advance, especially students who might, because of their prior personal experiences, find this even more difficult going than the ordinary individual with no such experience. I mean, reading about painful and difficult topics can be difficult for everyone, and different topics can be particularly painful for different people.
Is it possible that in an era where the movie The Texas Chainsaw Massacre has had like four or five sequels that it's very, very difficult to enforce anything like this?
Well, it depends on what you mean by enforce. I don't think anyone is suggesting, at the University of Chicago at least, that there be enforced trigger warnings. I will say, as somebody who teaches classes, all of which cut very close to the bone for most students and indeed most people, I teach on the regulation of sexuality, I teach on the regulation of religion. I do think it advisable to say on the first day of class, we are going to be talking about difficult subjects close to the bone for many of you, and we are going to talk about them very frankly. This is something you should know before deciding to take this class. some might call what I've just given a trigger warning. It doesn't shut down what it is I assign or how it is we talk about it. It simply alerts people to be prepared.
Is it possible that Dean Ellison was trying to preempt the kinds of things that happened in Oberlin, where, Taco Day at the cafeteria was turned into an accusation of anti-Latino cuisine offense and that sort of thing?
I don't know what happened at Oberlin, and I certainly don't know what was in the dean's mind. But again, my hope and assumption is that he was trying to paraphrase and convey the sentiments of what is indeed the university's official report on free expression.
If a white student used the N-word in the course of a discussion in your class and a black student objected, would that become an incident for the university administration?
I sure hope not. And such a thing is quite likely to happen in at least some of the classes I teach. I teach a class on the First Amendment. I wouldn't rule out having used that word in class myself. Everything depends on the context. Everything depends on the tone. And that is a relevant word for some classroom discussions, including some classroom discussions that the university hired me to conduct.
Marianne Case is a professor of law at the University of Chicago Law School. Thank you so much, Professor.
Thank you.
Susie Garfinkel calling from Delray Beach, Florida. And I am disgusted by this retrogressive decision at an institution I used to respect. I don't see how trigger warnings and safe spaces interfere with academic freedom.
Well, you guys love this one. Tampa, Florida students should be exposed to differing ideologies and thoughts that are challenging and sometimes even seriously upsetting. With that said, the University of Chicago is right to remind students that their university is a place for tough intellectual discussions and not retreat into puppy-lined spaces designed for preteens.
My name's Sandy, calling from Pennsylvania. Good for the University of Chicago. It's ridiculous. Safe zones and trigger warnings. I don't even know what trigger warnings are. Colleges are supposed to be a beacon of free speech, not politically correct Nazis. I don't understand today's generation.
Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Subscribe to our podcast. Find us on iTunes or on your favorite podcast app. It's a great way to check up on all the day's news. You can find us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. What's this tune, Men Without Hats? Is that right? There should be a safe space for this tune from the 80s. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.